From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Breitbart News, the alt-right website run by Trump supporter and former top advisor Steve Bannon, had this headline after yesterday's extraordinary speech from George W. Bush. Bush dynasty's firstborn emerges to bash Trump, a not too subtle dig at the former president. Now, most historians agree yesterday marked an extraordinary moment, but what does it mean? Both George W. Bush and Barack Obama broke with tradition and, without mentioning the sitting president by name, took him on. Here's President Bush in New York.
We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. At times, it can seem like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together. Argument turns too easily into animosity. Disagreement escalates into dehumanization.
And former President Obama in Virginia.
We've got folks who are deliberately trying to make folks angry, to demonize people who have different ideas, to get the base all riled up because it provides a short-term tactical advantage.
Douglas Brinkley is a professor of American history at Rice University and the author of a number of books on the American presidency. We wanted to get his opinion. Doug, your thoughts. Put this in historical context. How unusual is it to see former presidents issuing such a rebuke to the man in the Oval Office?
Well, it's very rare, very unusual. But after all, Donald Trump has been maligning Barack Obama all year long, saying that former President Obama had wiretapped him at Trump Tower, claiming that he didn't talk to Gold Star families. One could go on and on. He constantly tries to use President Obama as sort of his whipping child, a way to generate base support by being anti-Obama. So one can't be surprised that President Obama went on the campaign trail in New Jersey and Virginia and gave really powerful speeches. You can see why he was elected two times. He's a great orator. I was more surprised at George W. Bush willing to come out with such an eloquent and powerful speech, a real profiles and courage moment. And I think in that case, because he is a Republican and he's attacking a Republican president, it was very potent.
Well, to your points that you just made, you could say that President Trump has used both men to climb into office. He, as you said, used Barack Obama going back to the birtherism, but then also bashed the Bush brother Jeb on the campaign trail, took aim at the war in Iraq. But what does this tell you about the Republican Party? Stephen Collinson writes for CNN.com that, in fact, for Trump supporters and maybe the president himself, the reappearances of Obama and Bush on Thursday may have seemed less like a rebuke than a validation. After all, what better endorsement could there be of an anti-establishment campaign targeting Washington elites than running afoul of the two previous presidents?
Yes, but you could also connect the John McCain speech of this week into the conversation and then say, look, McCain and George W. Bush now are going after Donald Trump. And it tells us there's a civil war going on with the Republican Party for its heart and soul in 2018. This is about politics to a degree. And George W. Bush disdains xenophobia, bigotry, nativism. You know, remember when he was a governor of Texas, he was very kind of progressive on border issues with Mexico. As president, he gave so much American aid money to Africa to combat the AIDS epidemic. He has said that the one thing he can't stand is racism. And so he felt he had to come out, and now's the right time. I think George W. Bush and Obama wanted to give Trump a 6-month honeymoon in some ways, try to stay out of the way. But some of the things that have been happening with Donald Trump's Twitter and public pronouncements, they've been very galling, and it's kind of made everybody stand up and speak truth to power.
In fact, let's listen to just a few seconds when President Bush made the distinction between nationalism and nativism.
We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism.
Douglas Brinkley only got a couple seconds here, but he just threw down that gauntlet.
He threw down the gauntlet, and he could no longer stay out of the public fray. He has now entered American political life. As ex-president, he wanted to work on Wounded Warriors and the Bush Institute, but now he's part of the political news cycle.
Presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, thank you.
Well, now to Spain, where there's been uncertainty over the future of the region of Catalonia after its disputed independence vote earlier this month. This weekend, Spain's prime minister is taking steps to strip Catalonia of its self-rule. The government says it will hold regional elections in Catalonia in January. Reporter Lauren Freyer joins us now from Madrid. And Lauren, Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy is preparing to impose direct rule over Catalonia after a cabinet meeting tomorrow. How will that work?
So what he's expected to do is invoke Article 155 of the Spanish Constitution. It's an article that's never been used, and it allows the Spanish government to strip any one of Spain's 17 regions of its autonomy. Spain has 17 autonomous regions. Catalonia is one. Andalusia is another you may have heard of. And they enjoy powers to set policy on things like healthcare, education, and they rely on the central government for other things like tax collection. And why this is significant is because back in 1978, when Spain transitioned to democracy, the survival of the whole system here was thought to rest on this devolution of powers to the regions, reversing the centralized power of the dictator Francisco Franco, who died in 1975. So it's a really big deal to cancel those powers in Catalonia. They call it here the nuclear option. Hmm. What it means on the ground is probably first taking over the Catalan Regional Police Force, then firing, possibly even jailing, regional politicians. And then, as you mentioned, fresh elections, regional elections probably in January.
And meanwhile, the Catalan leader, Carles Puigdemont, says he has not actually declared independence, but that the Catalan parliament still might if Spain doesn't open dialogue. What are they waiting for?
Well, they had been holding out for dialogue. I mean, this past week has been a sort of week of deadlines, ultimatums come and passed. And whenever the Spanish government had asked Carles Puigdemont to drop his independence bid once and for all, he always asked for talks. Puigdemont's ruling coalition in Catalonia relies on the support of this far-left pro-independence party called the CUP. And they're a very small party, not mainstream, very pro-independence, and they're pushing him to declare independence now, immediately. And the Catalan regional parliament could vote to do so within days. I mean, it's really only symbolic. They're without recognition from any other country. No country in the world has said it would recognize an independent Catalonia. They can declare independence, but it will sort of fall on deaf ears. They're about to be taken over by Madrid anyway.
Hmm. Well, you're in Madrid right now. Barcelona, as we know, is the main city in Catalonia, but Madrid is not part of it. How are people feeling on both sides, inside of Catalonia and outside of Catalonia, about all of this?
So Madrid, where I am now and where I live, there's tremendous support for the Spanish government cracking down on Catalonia. I mean, my barrio is suddenly adorned with Spanish flags that weren't there a couple weeks ago. And they say, you know, now let's just finish off with this standoff. Let's take over. Let's restore order in Catalonia. In Barcelona, as you mentioned, the Catalan capital, it's a very different story. I mean, it has not been normal life there in about a month. But there's a sense in Catalonia that Madrid was going to do this all along, invoke this Article 155, you know, take over Catalonia. It was only a matter of time. Here's a 21-year-old college student named Julia. She doesn't think that Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy ever really listened to the Catalan leader Puigdemont, who sent him a letter yesterday asking for dialogue.
I think Rajoy didn't read the letter from Carles Puigdemont. So I think it doesn't matter what Puigdemont says. It's like they see us as a colony, I would say.
So that's just one separatist voice in Barcelona, but she's sort of resigned to the Spanish central government taking over control of her region.
The Guardian, Lauren, the Guardian newspaper, cites industry experts in Spain who say tourism is down 15% in Catalonia since the referendum. How is this affecting the economy?
There's been an exodus of dozens of companies who are saying they either are relocating already or will relocate from Catalonia to neighboring Spanish regions or even elsewhere in Europe if Catalonia gets independence. They want to stay under Spanish and, more importantly, European Union law. Today, separatist groups are asking their supporters to withdraw money from Catalan banks, which have said they'll relocate, so sort of punish those banks for relocating out of Catalonia. ATM machines are apparently out of 5 euro notes today because everyone is withdrawing 155 euros to symbolize the article 155. It's sort of a strange form of protest, you know, to create a run on the banks, which is actually exactly what Madrid and many economists have been warning about all along. If Catalonia were to break away, it might suffer a recession. And ratings agencies have warned of that as well. In autumn, tourism does fall off naturally after the summer high season. But anecdotally, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who have said, you know, we thought about changing our holiday plans because you just don't know. Are we going to be bombarded with street protests? People saw the violence at the polls during that disputed referendum on October 1st and think, you know what, maybe I'll go someplace else.
That's reporter Lauren Freyer in Madrid. Sounds like it's going to be a very busy weekend in Spain. Lauren, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Actress Lupita Nyong'o, an Academy Award winner for her role in 12 Years a Slave, wrote a bombshell op-ed in the New York Times today in which she said that while a student at Yale, producer Harvey Weinstein invited her to his home to watch a movie. He asked her to join him in his bedroom to watch it. Once there, he asked to give her a massage. She declined. There were other unwanted advances as well. She later said to him, "I just wanted to make sure we're good." He said, "I don't know about your career, but you'll be fine." So Lupita Nyong'o is hashtag Me Too. Femi Okeh is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She helps us look at the news through social media. And Femi, the Me Too movement was started by an African-American woman, Tarana Burke, a decade ago, picked up this week by actress Alyssa Milano. We've talked about it here, but you've been struck by how it took off.
It really did. It started on October the 15th for this recent iteration. And by the morning of October 16th, people were posting on each other's social media platforms, on their social media platforms, so much that they had to look up, what does actually Me Too mean? What is it even about?
What do you mean? Because they were just...
They didn't understand. It was this outpouring of stories and incidences that had happened to women around the world, from young to old. Mm. In France, women are posting. In Italy, women are posting. In Arab-speaking countries, women are also posting. So it happened so quickly that people didn't even realize what it was about.
In France, it's balance ton porc, rat out your pig, hashtag.
Very direct.
Look, there were other related hashtags that got started as well. An Australian journalist and activist, Benjamin Law, started the hashtag How I Will Change. What is that?
A couple of days into the Me Too phenomenon, the Me Too global share, Benjamin Law says, "Guys, it's our turn. After yesterday's endless Me Too stories of women being abused, assaulted and harassed, today we say hashtag how I will change." And then thousands of men started to pledge. How will they change? How will I change? I will never stay quiet and ignore harassment and abuse. Michael says, "I will never blame a victim. I will never stand and watch another man abuse or sexual harass a woman," and so on and so on. Robin, let me tell you about a little piece that is going viral right now again. And this is from a gentleman called Jackson Katz. He's really well known for being a pioneer of saying sexual harassment, sexual violence against women is a men's issue. Mm-hmm. It's not a woman's issue. Look up his TED talk. It's about violence against women. It's a men's issue. There's a little quote that everybody is sharing right now under the hashtag Me Too. It says, "We talk about how many women were raped last year, not about how many men raped women. We talk about how many girls in a school district were harassed last year, not how many boys harass girls," and so on and so on. You get the idea. It's actually kind of flipping the script. Mm. It's not about women. It's actually about men. Hmm. Let me leave you, because you mentioned Tarana Burke. And Tarana Burke was the woman who, 10 years ago, African-American woman, who actually started this hashtag because somebody told her a very personal story about sexual harassment. And she should have said she thought Me Too, and she ran away. She was too scared to engage. She isn't now. Mm. She says, "Since Me Too became popularized, it has become a tool for healing across the spectrum of survivors around the world. And I'm glad." I leave you with that because I'm always pretty skeptical about hashtag movements and the way that things take off very quickly on Twitter and Facebook. But Tarana Burke says this is important. This counts. These stories matter.
Femi, okay. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Tell her that I'm any other way.
That voice from the R&B and soul music world of the 1960s is Jackie Shane, but it was only heard publicly for about a decade before she all but disappeared in 1971. Before that, she always attracted attention. Jackie Shane was born an African-American boy in 1940 in segregated Nashville, Tennessee. But when she took the stage there at the Sapphire Tavern in Toronto, she was a star who wore wigs and makeup and beautiful gowns. She was a transgender pioneer, a man living as a woman before that term had even been coined. Recently, producers from the record company Numero Group found Jackie Shane, 77 now, living alone back in Nashville. They're releasing a box set of her recordings today. And New York Times pop culture reporter Reggie Ugwu also found Jackie Shane and had a rare phone interview with her. He joins us now. And Reggie, I shouldn't say rare, it was the only phone interview with her.
Yeah, you know, we were really fortunate and able to come first with the story on her. She hadn't spoken to the press extensively ever, really, in her career.
Right. Just give us a little more context. I mean, when she moved to Toronto, that song, Any Other Way, was such a hit there that it was number two ahead of Skeeter Davis's The End of the World and just below the Chiffons' He's So Fine.
Yeah, two sort of iconic songs from the era, and Jackie was a rare sort of local artist to make that kind of impact in Toronto at the time. So that gives you a sense of, you know, the waves that she was making.
Yeah, and talk about how astonishing this is, given where she came from. We're talking 1940s, 1950s, Jim Crow South. She's not just black, but openly, well, how would you describe it?
Well, she says that she described herself as gay, and that's kind of the community that she was involved in at the time. But, you know, she told me that she didn't really spend much time trying to explain or describe her identity to people. She said, people didn't explain themselves to me, so why should I have to explain myself to them?
Yeah. This is in the South. Even as a child in the schoolyard, you say, when somebody tried to bully her, she took a jump rope and, you know, thrashed him. She wore this defiance openly.
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable story. And Jackie says that, you know, aside from that schoolyard incident, she didn't have that much trouble. I think she was able to disarm people with sort of a strong self-confidence, and she didn't hide who she was. She wasn't ashamed. She wasn't embarrassed. She was just Jackie, as she said. And I think that she was able to sort of disarm people with her charisma.
They say a little bit.
That's Jackie Shane singing Berry Gordy's Money, which was recorded by black artists starting in 1959, before it was a hit for the Beatles. But Reggie Ugwu, she puts a rap in the middle also. Let's listen.
You know, when I'm walking down Young Street, you won't believe this, but you know some of them funny people have the nerve to point the finger at me and grin and smile and whisper. But you know that don't worry, Jackie, because I know I look good. And every Monday morning I laugh and grin on my way to the bank, because I got mine. I look good, I got money, and everything else that I need. You know what my slogan is? Baby, do what you want. Just know what you're doing. As long as you don't force your will and your way on anybody else, live your life, because ain't nobody sanctified and holy.
Well, Reggie, that is pretty radical.
Yeah, it's amazing. I love that clip because you, right there, you get sort of a crystallization of her whole philosophy, her whole worldview. And you know, on the stage is one of the few places where she felt that she could truly be herself. And not only that, but advance her message and really reach out and connect with people in an authentic way.
What did she tell you about why she just disappeared?
Well, she says that she was very, very close with her mother, who was one of the few people who she loved and trusted, you know, unreservedly in her life. And her mother was getting older on in years, and her husband died. Jackie's stepfather passed away. And after a certain point, she said she decided to go home and be closer to her. And she lived in, very close with her mother and took care of her. She had Alzheimer's until she passed in 1997.
Well, you also tried to figure out how she's living now after her mother passed. She went back to Nashville, and she rarely goes out. What's your sense of how she's surviving?
It's fascinating. I mean, you know, Jackie is an extraordinarily self-reliant, sort of self-sufficient person. And I think you get a sense talking to her that she just, frankly, doesn't have that much use for other people. And you know, so where it's kind of a natural thing for her to be alone and sort of do things on her own time. And so where you or I might look at it and think that, you know, it's unthinkable or lonely or strange to be, you know, that kind of isolated or to not mingle, as Jackie puts it, for such a long period of time. For her, it's just kind of natural. And, you know, she's quite happy, I think. She loves to order Domino's, she told me. She has an extensive library of old Hollywood films. And so it's very extraordinary life in some ways, but also kind of recognizable. You know, she likes to watch TV and to watch, keeps up with the news and takes care of her cat.
Well, and sign the release for this box set that's coming out of her work. By the way, we should say the record company couldn't get her to come to the door, but they slid it under the door and she signed it. Is there a chance she might come back?
She's been kind of teasing that idea, that prospect of a return to the stage. She doesn't want to give a timeline, but, you know, she wants to go back to Toronto first of all and perform there in front of a crowd again. You know, it's just kind of have to wait and see what happens.
With bated breath. Reggie Ugwu, pop culture reporter for the New York Times. We'll link you to his reporting on Jackie Shane and more about the box set of her work that's coming out today. Reggie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Jackie, I hope you're listening. It's Here and Now.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Two major American companies are getting walloped on Wall Street this week. Shares of General Electric fell 3% at the opening bell this morning after a disappointing earnings report. And United Airlines saw its stock spiral 12% yesterday. These companies are struggling even as the stock market continues to hit new highs. Joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's start with GE. The company had a bad third quarter. It says it'll shrink in the next 2 years by selling off $20 billion worth of its businesses. What's going on?
Well, the most acute issue with General Electric is, after this earnings report especially, is there's a lot of speculation that they will not have enough of cash flow to cover their dividend payments to shareholders. Mm. And when a company cuts its dividend, or even if there's speculation that it'll cut its dividend to shareholders, it's just poison for a stock price. And it's interesting that GE shares have recovered a lot of those early losses today, but still down about 26% on the year. And I think if you look at the big picture over the long term, GE just got too big. Its operations got too sprawling in way too many industries. And even its attempts to, you know, diversify into financial services, for example, came right before the financial crisis. And lately, some of its problems have been in the energy industry with oil prices recovering, but still being kind of a tepid recovery. So I think the goal with GE is to kind of refocus and shrink its business back to sort of its more core focus.
And GE just got a new CEO, John Flannery, over the summer. So is that what he said he wants to do, is refocus?
Yeah, and he's going to give an update on the strategy next month. But like you said, they want to sell about $20 billion in assets. So that will likely mean just selling off big chunks of its business. What exactly they are going to sell off is not clear yet. Some analysts are speculating that they'll sell off the transportation business, their lighting business, and basically a lot of businesses that aren't core to their traditional business.
Now, there was also an earnings call yesterday with United Airlines CEO that didn't go well. What happened?
Well, it's funny. These calls are usually pretty cordial between analysts and CEOs and chief financial officers. This one just kind of got very testy. Oscar Munoz was asked to update some of the company's financial targets on its cost-cutting efforts and how it's going to manage its capacity of airline seats. And he just didn't have updates of the numbers that the analysts wanted. And there was a lot of – you could sense the frustration on the part of the analysts. So it's sort of unusual to get that testy of an exchange between executives and the analysts. And the stock, you know, just started really going into free fall almost during that conference call. And by the end of it, there were people speculating that, you know, they might be changing management again and that, you know, he just did not come through on the call with the information that these analysts want. So very unusual situation.
Well, and it must be very difficult to be a major company that is not doing so well when the whole stock market is hitting new records.
That's absolutely right. It's very tough to be the CEO, to say to put it gently, when you know the market's up 13-14% on the year and your stock price is down in double digits for the year. And it's really, you know, the stock market's really been led by the big technology firms this year. So these companies aren't really participating in that.
That's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said this week that his country's biggest mistake after the Cold War was that it had put too much trust in Western countries like the U.S., and the West had abused that trust. His remarks come on the 55th anniversary of one of the Cold War's flashpoints. 55 years ago this week, the world came to the brink of nuclear war in what became known as the Cuban Missile Crisis. In October 1962, President John F. Kennedy responded to reports of the Soviets setting up nuclear ballistic missiles in Cuba with an order to blockade the island. The standoff lasted nearly 2 weeks. Here's President Kennedy addressing the nation on October 22, 1962.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
So what can we learn about today's international conflicts from the Cuban Missile Crisis? For more, we're joined by Timothy McEwen, a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
And many people in the U.S. know the outlines of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but you say that many forget the context. This comes a year after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, in which a group of CIA-trained Cuban exiles tried to overthrow Castro, and the U.S. had put ballistic missiles in Turkey. What do you think most people misunderstand today about what happened in 1962?
I think the standard view is essentially the movie 13 Days, which shows a purely bilateral confrontation that's mostly about military issues, and it basically explains U.S. success in terms of superior resolve and courage. And while resolve and courage certainly have something to do with it, there was a lot more going on than just that.
Well, tell us what was going on at the time.
Well, for one thing, the missiles in Cuba, like the missiles in North Korea, were not a complete surprise. The United States began worrying about missiles in Cuba, ballistic missiles in Cuba, after the Bay of Pigs invasion. And when the Soviets began a substantial arms buildup in Cuba in the summer of 1962, the U.S. began receiving reports from the island that ballistic missiles might be included in those arms shipments. Most of those reports were dismissed as unreliable, but by the late fall, enough information had accumulated that Secretary of Defense McNamara in particular began to take those reports very seriously. So the U.S. began planning for the possibility of Soviet missiles long before the U.S. uncovered them with the U-2 flights.
And what about the missiles in Turkey, the U.S. missiles in Turkey?
That's a good question. When Eisenhower decided in 1959 to go ahead with the installation of the missiles in Turkey, one of the remarks he made at the time was strangely prophetic. He said he understood that the Soviets, looking at this installation, could conclude that what they ought to do is put missiles someplace like Mexico or Cuba. Now, when Eisenhower said this, Castro was in power in Cuba, but the direction of his revolution wasn't so clear-cut. But after the Bay of Pigs, it became apparent that Castro would probably move closer to the Soviets. The Soviets would probably provide him with more aid. So internal discussions within the U.S. government about the possibility of Soviet ballistic missiles began to happen that spring.
I want to listen to another piece of tape. This is from October 25th, 1962, at a meeting of the UN Security Council, and Kennedy's ambassador to the UN, Adlai Stevenson, famously browbeat the Russian ambassador, asking him whether the USSR had missiles on Cuba. Yes or no, he asked. Here's the Russian ambassador replying through a translator.
Mr. Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in the due course. Do not worry. I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
How crucial was that meeting, and what does it say about how the U.S. used diplomacy to put pressure on the Soviet Union?
I think the meeting became the soundbite heard around the world. It received a great deal of attention at the time. And as you can guess, the White House was delighted with the way Stevenson performed. But this was all part of a much larger diplomatic effort that the U.S. engaged in. It saw Cuba as part of a larger Cold War story. It also saw Cuba as having effects on U.S. relations with Latin America and, for that matter, U.S. relations with all of its allies throughout the world. So U.S. efforts during the missile crisis were as much diplomatic as they were military. They were intent on shoring up support from allies and doing the best they could to politically isolate the Soviet Union.
What ultimately resolved the Cuban Missile Crisis?
That's a really good question. I don't know that either the Soviets or the Americans were fully in control of events, but certainly when Khrushchev decided that the risks of war were becoming high, he became more receptive to a solution. But people, I think, miss the main lesson or one of the main lessons of this crisis if they think the Americans simply squeezed the Soviets and the Soviets cried uncle. For the Soviets to agree to remove the missiles, they had to get some concessions. First, they had to have the Americans agree that they would end the blockade. Secondly, they succeeded in extracting an agreement from the U.S. that the U.S. would not invade Cuba. Finally, the concession that's received the most attention lately because it was the one that was the most carefully concealed was the trade of the missiles in Turkey for the missiles in Cuba. Once the Turks indicated that they would be amenable to this solution, it was relatively easy for the U.S. to go ahead and do this.
I was speaking with somebody the other day. I wasn't alive during the Cuban Missile Crisis, but he was, and he said that he felt much more worried then about the danger of a nuclear war than he does today with what's going on with North Korea. What do you think? Was there a greater chance of nuclear war then than there is now?
Well, when John Kennedy was asked this question during the missile crisis, he said the probability of a nuclear war was between 1 in 4 and 50-50. I think that's as reasonable an estimate as we could make for that time. I just read this morning a speech by the former CIA director Brennan where he said the probability of war in the current situation is around 20 to 25%. I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but I do know that there is a significant chance that we could have a war in the Korean situation.
And can we learn anything from what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis that would apply to today?
Well, I think probably the most telling lesson is that third parties were really instrumental in the outcome in Cuba. And I think the role of third parties in the Korean situation is also going to be critical, particularly the role of South Korea and of Japan. It's hard to imagine a solution emerging that doesn't meet with the consent of those two countries. And I think if the U.S. uses force against North Korea without securing the consent of the South Koreans in particular, that this could have really quite negative political consequences.
What about the difference between how Kennedy handled the Cuban Missile Crisis and made his decisions and how the Trump administration is making decisions now?
It's hard to know a lot about how the Trump administration makes its decisions, but it seems to have a rather narrow set of officials involved in this process. And they all seem to have similar backgrounds. They are either close to the president or they're military or ex-military. In the Kennedy years, national security decision-making was made by a much broader array. Kennedy's national security advisor, George Bundy, was a Republican. McNamara and Dillon were Republicans, too. It wasn't crazy or unheard of to have Republicans in your cabinet then. And during the crisis, Kennedy reached out to Eisenhower and called him up and asked him his opinion. He didn't have any problem talking to both Republicans and Democrats in Congress about what he was doing, and he kept them up to date on what the administration was doing. So in that regard, it's a very different world than the world that we live in now.
That's Timothy McEwen, who is a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, talking with us as we mark the 55th anniversary this week of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Professor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
True crime TV fans are already obsessing over Netflix's new procedural drama, Mindhunters, released last Friday. It's set in the 1970s, the very early days of criminal profiling, and it tells the story of an FBI agent trying to change the way the Bureau deals with killers. Let's listen.
California jails are full of thrill killers and lust murderers.
And we put them there. That's our job.
Dying and rotting on the vine.
Cry me a river, holding all the wasted potential.
It is wasted potential, sir. It is, because we could be using these people.
Using how?
Their knowledge and insight.
Of what?
Themselves.
Whose selves?
Then we might know what we're talking about when we speak to other law enforcement.
Can you make him shut up?
I have not been able to do that, sir.
Jonathan Groff stars as Holden Ford, a character based on real-life FBI agent John Douglas. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us. Eric, first, procedural dramas. I had not heard that reference to these shows.
Yeah, sure. That's police procedurals is a way to refer to a lot of the cop shows that we see on television that show us the procedure by which police officers come across a crime and then solve it.
There's whole cable channels devoted to them.
Exactly. And so now with Mindhunter, we have this really interesting setup where they're taking a character that's based on Douglas and they're showing him trying to push the FBI to develop a department where they would speak to serial killers and they portray actual serial killers. So people like Ed Kemper and Richard Speck and Jerome Brudos. And so they go to meet with these people and they use the details of their actual crimes, but they make up scenes where they interact with these people and talk to them about why they did what they did and then try to see the larger patterns that they would then use to profile a potential murderer later down the line. Now, we've got a great clip from the show that talks about this a little bit, that shows the guys talking to Ed Kemper. Let's check it out.
People who hunt other people for a vocation, all we want to talk about is what it's like.
Right, sure.
It's not easy butchering people's hard work. Physically and mentally, I don't think people realize you need to vent. What are you writing down?
Oh, I just think it's an interesting choice of words. Vocation.
Well, what would you call it? A hobby? I'd say it's more than that. Is this helping? Are you getting what you came for?
I think.
good.
So it's interesting for viewers to watch this because we are on the other end of decades of drama that sort of portray situations like this. You know, movies like Silence of the Lambs, even a TV show like Hannibal, you know, they took it for granted the idea that the FBI and law enforcement would see value in talking to successful serial killers to find out how they do what they do. But this show takes place at a time before all of that is accepted wisdom. And we see this character, Holden, trying to push against the establishment and get them to, you know, accept it. And what's interesting to me, the character's name, Holden, I thought was a reference to actually Holden Caulfield, in the sense that he's a bit of a rebel within the establishment of the FBI.
You mentioned Holden Caulfield from J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. But here, the serial killer is Ed Kemper. He was known as the co-ed killer. It's creepy, and I can see how it could be, you know, seductive, too, to watch it. But is there any, you know, any sense of, you know, this is glorifying them?
I don't think so, because when you watch the show, they're villainy personified in a weird way. And I think one of the interesting things about the show is that it shows how banal these guys can seem on the surface. But once you get to know what's driving their pathology, you see that they're sort of horrifically damaged people. And I would expect a creepy series from David Fincher, the executive producer, who, you know, directed Seven. So,
yeah.
You know,
you're going to get
creepiness. But what the show is really about, especially in the later episodes, is what impact this has on the FBI agents. You know, there's some scenes where Holden talks to these guys in a way that's very upsetting because he's trying to empathize with them and get them to open up. Mm-hmm. But along the way, that's doing something to him as well. And to me, that's the interesting part of the story is that, you know, this little team of people working for the FBI pioneering a type of profiling, a type of science that it's not ready to face.
Mm. Well, some critics are comparing it to the AMC drama Mad Men, but with serial killers. But why do you think these crime wave shows, I mean, this has been going on for a couple decades now. Why do you think people get pulled into them?
Well, I mean, it's something you can relate to, right? I mean, as you said, you know, we've been seeing cops and criminals on TV since the days of Dragnet in the 50s and 60s. But to get a sense that you're getting an authentic story. And so we're hearing that this show, for example, is going to tackle the Atlanta child murders, which is something that, you know, some people may not be conversant with. Mm-hmm. There's a killer that's portrayed in the first season that seems to be like a notorious killer who operated for something like 30 years in America. I'm not going to say who it is because I don't want to drop the spoiler, but that's a tantalizing piece of information. So we're going to get a different kind of look at crimes that maybe we haven't heard of or that we've forgotten about or that we thought we knew but we don't know as well as we thought we did. And that's what the best television does, is sort of present this stuff to us in a new way.
Yeah. That's NPR's television critic Eric Deggans. Eric, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, Weekend Viewing. Serial Killers. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.